Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And that debt is fraud. And as we kind of lay this out, we have to hold our government accountable. They're going to continually run us into the ground by destroying our economy, by inflating our currency, blah, 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 blah. So, folks, we have to understand what they're doing wrong. When we kind of go through the Tory Acts, we cover the documents that established the footings for the course of Britain and the empire that ended up developing out of this little isle called Britain. The Magna Carta started this off, and the Glorious Bill of Rights. We inherited these things. And when we were a part of the colonies of England, of Great Britain, we actually understood our responsibilities as Englishmen. We understood our rights as Englishmen. The Glorious Revolution had just occurred less than a century ago. Therefore, our forefathers knew and recognized tyranny when the king started dismantling the colony governments and started injecting or in putting in place his own governors to basically start ruling us with a heavy hand. Because this is the beginning of when he decided to use the colonies, the strong economy of the colonies, to fund his war throughout the empire, to basically help underwrite his war machine that he was beginning to exercise more aggressively. Therefore, the people had one simple demand. The people demanded, with taxation comes representation. We have a right to be in Parliament. Think about this, folks. The business decision of the king was to choose to either wage tyranny upon the people to pay for his warfare, and in so doing, pay for the warfare against these people to pay for the warfare that he wants to wage throughout the empire, or succumb to the logical demands of these Englishmen in the colonies and give them representation. If you understand how insane it was, a good businessman would have been an easy decision. Give them representation. Open up some seats in Parliament. If we got to build a new Parliament, we're building a new Parliament. Because that is far cheaper to bring them in and then to be able to utilize their strong economy in doing the empire's business around the world. So as we learn these things, as we kind of go through and we see the bigger picture, and then we look at the nuances of our government and those rights, these responsibilities as citizens that we have, as we learn, pray, and act, I believe we will be acting just like our forefathers, with the knowledge of what we're supposed to do. If we're just an illiterate society that depends completely on government to tell us what to do, then we deserve the situation we're living. And I don't think anybody deserves that, especially any child of God deserves that. But again, I digress. So the whole point is, and it all just gets distilled down to this. We, the people, have the power and have the law on our side in holding government accountable. That Constitution gives us everything we need to hold our government accountable, to actually force them into fulfilling their oath of office or removing them. Because our government aren't the buildings. Our government is not the bombs. Those buildings, bombs, and everything else are things that we've given them under the auspices of the Constitution to be able to protect our sovereignty, and now they're using or preparing to use those things on us, and which kind of leads to kind of an opening discussion I want to have. Welcome back, Sean. So
good to be here, sir. Thank you.
Well, you're not prepared for this because I don't like anybody that works with me. Just forewarning. I don't like to discuss what we're going to talk. And it's not because I want to blindside anybody. But what I want to do is I want to have the discussion one time, you know, with you, the audience, being hearing this. Because what I have found is when we discuss things before and then we start discussing in front of you, there's lots of things that get left out because I think I already mentioned that, didn't I? You know, because you start thinking about these arguments and points, and a lot of times they don't surface in the second conversation. So to avoid that, so that we actually have a really good, detailed discussion, it's, you know, worthy of just kind of not discussing it. So I guess I could have given you a heads up because I'm not sure. Are you hearing any rumblings in your quadrant of this republic that there is going to be an exercise of military force and potentially martial law declared throughout the land?
I mean, on the fringes, you hear that all the time. We've yes. been supposedly going into martial law for ever. Supposedly that, according to Q, we've been in martial law the whole time that Trump was in office from 2016, and Biden was just theater. But so you never know what to believe about that.
Well, okay, so we know that they don't have the authority to regulate the environment, but they're spending a lot of money and doing a lot of regulating because we have failed to hold them accountable to basically say, you don't have the authority to do that. Until we start doing that, they're going to continue to get away with tyranny. So that being said, they may have established martial law, but they have no legitimate authority to do it under the stipulations and under the terms of the Constitution. There are very specific things that have to take place, and there's a very specific way of applying martial law in America. And I covered this in the article, Martial Law in the 21st Century. Because Congress took the militia away from the states unconstitutionally, Congress no longer is exercising the proper authority of calling forth the militia. They've taken full possession. And so in so doing, the possession of Congress and their current management of Congress is all tyrannical. And now they basically created, under this Dick Act of 1903, the National Guard, the National Air Guard under that, and all these other national things as national resources, where the Constitution clearly did not give them the authority to do this. And in addition to that, now that they just possess them, they said, well, now we can just declare martial law. No, 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 no. And in the document, Martial Law in the 21st Century, the only way they can declare martial law as stipulated in the ratification debates is they can only declare it to the area where the militia that has been called up by Congress and federalized is to be deployed. Therefore, during the Whiskey Rebellion, it was in Western Pennsylvania and Western Pennsylvania only where the militia was deployed, and that's where martial law was declared. And actually, they didn't even go that far because it was literally just going in there, seizing the rebel rousers, 24 of them, and bringing them back. Because everybody else dispersed and went home once you took the leaders of the packs, so to speak. And so they didn't even need to set up a tribunals or anything like that. They were prepared to if it would have lingered longer. But there was no need to actually set up martial law. But martial law, again, can only be declared where the militia has been federalized and deployed. So if you don't have the militia deployed in the state of Montana, and actually if Montana state government is exercising their authority by repelling the invaders, because let's say that's the cause, because that's the rumor here, right? That, you know, this whole fight back and deporting these bad players when the Constitution demands that they be repelled, they be deported, all of them, not just the bad players, all of them, then, you know, the fact that if there's states that are actually, you know, going along with it, martial law cannot be applied to the people in that state. It can only be applied to where they're actually going and exercising the power that they have in repelling the invaders, because the city and state governments are refusing to fulfill their oaths of office. Are you with me so far? Any questions or any points or contentions you want to bring up, or some clarity you need or anything like that? And you know what? I think you might actually, are you muted or what? Or is it me?
Oh, yeah, I was muted. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Okay, so.
But I was saying that there are states where the executives are not repelling. They're refusing to repel the invaders.
Right.
They're actually providing them a sanctuary.
Yes, yes. Okay, so what are we supposed to do with that? So instead of deploying the National Guard, instead of, you know, just going to war, how about enforcing the law first with those who are violating the law? Just work with me on this. Because I live in a state that is flagrantly, the governor and the state government is flagrantly violating the Constitution. The supreme law of the land already has the law or the standard, the eligibility of a person to be able to be in office is they must, in everything they do, fulfill that oath of office by supporting the Constitution. If at any point in time while they're under oath, they violate the Constitution by failing to do something that the Constitution demands, or by giving aid and comfort to those who are violating it, in other words, protecting them and not calling them out, saying, hey, hold on here, you're obligated to do this, and because you're not doing it, you're in violation. Either you start doing what you're supposed to be doing, or we're removing you, because that is the supreme law of the land. Trump's job is not to wage war against the states and against these unconstitutional offices. It is to actually what? To faithfully execute the law. So Trump's job is to actually deploy whatever force necessary to remove these governors, these state legislatures, and these state judges, as well as federal judges, as well as members of Congress. See, here's, everybody's going, oh, you know, this, they can't happen. They won't do that because nobody will go along with it. And I'm going to tell you otherwise. It is this easy. When Trump actually starts executing, let's say, because I believe the first place he should focus is with Congress. And with Congress, I believe that all he has to do is the president is basically say, we're going to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But what we're going to do, because we've already done an investigation, and we've identified AOC and start listing the names of people that are directly leading bills that are insurrections against the Constitution in Congress. In other words, the leadership, Pelosi, all of these people, Schumer, all of these people who are directly violating their oath, that are demanding everybody step in line with their agenda. Those people are identified and say, we're going to come and we're leaving you. And here's the charges, and we've got you dead to rights. And then while they're executing that first one, they're also saying, we're going to give a first and final to anybody and everybody where there is enough adequate evidence that you were just doing what you're told. But moving forward, whenever you do anything, if you have no confidence and whether it is a constitutional act or not, whether you're going to be violating your oath or not, you better ask and you better find out. Because if it's deemed, and lo and behold, because of your ignorance on the Constitution, it is actually a violation, you won't have a second chance. We will remove you then. What would happen? Well, I'm going to tell you what would happen. Those people that are left in office, they're going to actually be tiptoeing. They're going to be very, very careful. Because they just saw the leadership just get pulled away. Literally removed from office. and no longer will ever be in office of public trust or a prophet or anything at all. They cannot be a public servant. They're banned permanently for the rest of their lives. So, and now he turns over to the courts and the federal courts and actually starts removing judges. While they're out doing that, I'm going to tell you, Congress is watching what's happening, and the rest of the United States is watching what's happening. And then Trump basically lays out, we're coming to the states next. We're coming to the states next. Therefore, any governor, any legislator, any judge that wants to not repel invaders, we're removing you. You have no choice on this. There is not an amendment that has removed the responsibility of every person under oath to support the repelling of invaders. The Constitution demands it. You're not willing to do it. That means you're willing to actually violate your oath. We're removing you. And then everybody else, we're going to start giving you a first and final. And moving forward on not just this issue, on all issues under the Constitution, you better do your due diligence, because this is a first and final. You violate in any way your oath, we're going to remove you. Now, do you think once this starts and he starts removing the real problem, do you think he needs to use force and martial law to start repelling invaders?
No, I think the threat of them losing their position is going to get them in line.
Well, so.
But I think they'll all turn around on him to save themselves.
And so that's one of the reasons why. Here's the real problem. Because I have this problem in state legislatures of good people that say, you know, we're not willing to hold ourselves accountable. And so here's the beautiful thing about Trump. They can't turn the tables on the president. In other words, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment doesn't apply to the president.
Well, they'll try to say he's doing an insurrection like he did before, like they did before, and impeach him.
Okay, but actually all of the instigators of the insurrection before are now gone out of Congress, and the judges that have been supporting the actual insurrection against the Constitution and against the federal government. I mean, it's all been a political, you know, Democrat or conservative, progressive. In other words, as long as they continue to use the ambiguity of progressive, conservative, you know, moral tyranny and immoral tyranny, because that is the real problem here. We actually have a two-sided government, but they're not willing to get rid of the tyranny. And with Trump heading down this path, potentially heading down this path of exercising tyranny instead of actually exercising the law, I got a problem with it. But there is a constitutional process that actually solves the problem. The Constitution solves the problem. So, if you're hearing these types of things, folks, then what you're getting exposed to is the next level of tyranny that's going to become the new norm. And I've said this for years. America doesn't want justice and the rule of law. They want vengeance, and they want to apply their moral tyranny or their immoral tyranny. They're caught up in utilizing the tyranny of government to basically inflict upon everybody else. We're going to have a theocracy, and our theocracy is going to be godlessness and immorality. Our theocracy is going to be, you know, basically bowing to the, you know, Christianity, or it'll be a Christian moral theocracy, and we're going to inflict this upon everybody. And neither are accurate. Neither are within the Constitution or within the framework. Our government can't do those things. They don't have the authority. They're not supposed to be involved in those things. The point is that we have, I think we see presented to us a real opportunity to, you know, to create the clarity of what should really be happening. There's too many people that are involved in the chatter way out in the, you know, the ether sphere that are contributing to the problem. Ignorance and maintaining ignorance is literally contributing to the problem. Because like I said, the Constitution has everything it needs. We have everything we need in the Constitution to solve every one of these problems. So as we now move forward. So let's get back into the content. What we were covering, folks, is the document called the Bank Bill. The Bank Bill is a summation in the Congressional Record. Actually, it's in the Founders Archive on the Library of Congress, where they kind of created a summation of the Bank Bill. We kind of went through the debates, the four debates, what Madison, Ames, Jefferson, and Hamilton said. That's what we just went through. But now we're kind of looking at somebody kind of compiling and summarizing with some citations what, you know, what was done in this Bank Bill. And so we kind of left off on the second page, and we're going to pick up in, let me see here. Well, there's a run-on paragraph. So the first, second paragraphs on the second page we've completed. I think we actually read this paragraph, the third paragraph that we're going to start off with. But I think rereading this is important because I have to emphasize, I have to consistently and repetitively point out how Madison consistently pointed to the ratification debates and how the Constitution was defined to the states during those debates is the only legal terms of understanding that Constitution. It is, again, I've used this term before, it is the metric in understanding what those clauses mean. It is not for the judges to tell us what they mean. They did it for us. And that's the beauty of contract law. In the process of negotiating a contract, the ratification process, when there are clarities provided to those lines that are provided to those with the authority of ratification, they choose to either follow, you know, one side or the other. And because every state decided to follow what the Federalists were selling, what the Federalists sold becomes appendages or actually bibliographies or defining definitions and clarity and or stipulations to the clauses within the Constitution. They're legally binding. That is a fundamental part of contract law. And there's not one contract law court out there where the judge would say, hey, was that stipulated? If you can prove that something was stipulated in the process of accepting the purchase of a car or the selling of a home, whatever it is that the contract, the transaction is being covered and the justifications that were put in or stipulations that were put in that process, they're legally binding. The problem that you carry in court today is, can you prove that that stipulation was made? We don't have that problem when it comes to the Constitution because they wrote it down. It's not about, you know, hearsay. It's not about words. You know, what did they say? Well, we think they said these things. No, they wrote it down. They told us what they said. Doesn't that make it so much easier? It's like the scripture of them speaking to us from the dust, giving us those legal terms and definitions so that we can actually, with authority and assurance, shift our paradigm into the direction of the way we actually need to be looking at this. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So
I wanted to remind you, just going back a second, you were talking about the 14th Amendment, Section 3.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Did you hear about Representative Plaskett?
No.
Yesterday, what happened was they had a bunch of Epstein files that got released.
Uh-huh.
Emails and text messages.
Okay.
His personal text messages from his phone.
Okay.
And as part of a court case, it wasn't like a administration release or whatever. It got released because of a court order.
Right. They subpoenaed and his records. Right.
They timed up. They figured out the phone numbers.
So, Sean, I hate to say this. I didn't realize we were going into break. And so, unfortunately, Sean is talking, and so we're heading into break at this point in time. And so hopefully Sean will recognize this in the next 10 seconds so that we can go clean into break, and we'll come back and I'll let Sean pick up where he left off. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, Sean, so forgive me. I had no idea that as soon as you started talking, we were going right into break. And folks, in all fairness, Sean can't hear the music when he's talking because it's kind of like the old radio ways where once you push the little plunger on the microphone of the radio, when you're, you know, talking to Radio Central or what have you, you can't hear any of their transmissions. And so it's kind of like that. And so forgive me, Sean, for going into that. Just go ahead. You were bringing up the fact that there was a representative. The court actually subpoenaed or authorized the subpoena and the capturing of personal documents and records of this person, and it was being brought forward. So go ahead and finish what you're saying.
Yeah, and they had some independent journalists who took the information and they linked up the phone numbers and the timestamps on the messages. And he went back and pulled up the video, and Representative Plaskett is in a hearing and she's interviewing Michael Cohen when they were trying to impeach Trump. And Jeffrey Epstein is texting her while she's interviewing Michael Cohen. And as they play the video and look at the timestamps, you can see where they're having a text conversation where Epstein is telling her what to ask Michael Cohen in the House chamber. And she's texting him back. Uh-huh. He's like, ask him this. And she's like, oh, I don't know who that is. And you can see her on her phone texting. And then she puts her phone down and asks the question that Epstein told her to ask.
Okay. And, okay, so.
So who's running the government if the representatives are being coached on their interviews in House investigations?
Yeah, so the corruption, those who control the money, because in this, you know, vast swamp of corruption in our government, there are people that have the strategic plans. Obama's one of those guys. And as a matter of fact, he was the director and orchestrator of very specific insurrections against the Constitution. But he should have done it, because one of the things we learned a long time ago is plausible deniability. Do you know what that comes from? That term, no. Plausible deniability, I believe, goes all the way back to John F. Kennedy, where they were doing things that they wanted to make sure, and they were trying to do good things, but they wanted to make sure they didn't get in trouble with, you know, the fact that they did it. They were trying to bring things out so that people would be aware what was happening. So plausible deniability became a standard for both the... Actually, it was being used by the corrupt. It's just that this is where the good people started realizing, hey, you know, if we use plausible deniability, we might be able to help attune, you know, the reporters, the people, what have you, to go start looking under the right rocks and so forth. So that's, it sounds to me like Epstein was one of those who had a role in the narrative and or the he had at least a good understanding of the operations that had occurred or what had occurred actually with Cohen and so forth, which is why he was providing her those very specific questions. Absolutely. So the point of the introduction of this information is, can she be held accountable to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? Because I think that's what you started it off with.
Right.
So, I, you know, the Constitution says you can do these things. It says you can't do these things. In a court of law, you know, that's something different. Was what, as she was functioning in this investigation, was she in violation of her oath of office by, you know, having somebody whispering in her ear and listening to and asking the questions?
How could she not be?
Well, so it's that. So the so here's the thing. Congress
is she not elected to represent the people of her district and not Jeffrey Epstein?
Well, so technically the oath of office has nothing to, there's no legal obligation for people in the House of Representatives. House of Representatives, there's no legal obligation to give, you know, them suffrage per se, every single one of them. They have to kind of make sure that they're supporting everybody. And so this, I've kind of mentioned that the House of Representatives has this real big ambiguity, especially because of the almost million people that they represent. It's almost impossible for them, for anybody to challenge whether they were representing somebody in their district or not. So you could probably swing a bat and, you know, hit a couple of people that say, yeah, I agree with what they were doing. But the only legislative body in Congress, like i.e. the Senate, they don't have latitude on what they do. Anything and everything they do is should be at the desires of the state legislature. They don't have the authority to, you know, go rogue or what have you. If they do, the state legislature should be pulling them in. And as a matter of fact, just as a note, I've actually reached out. I've tried to contact, I believe, the state chair of Georgia and, you know, somebody within the executive leadership in the state of Arizona to help them understand that as the party, you need to start holding that state legislature accountable for not demanding their suffrage in the Senate. I believe that when we actually start talking about the real problems, instead of ignoring them and believing the lies of these problems, this is how we fix government. This is how we actually start fixing things. And I'm trying to do this because I'm very afraid of Trump having his way in destroying the filibuster and in destroying the architecture of the Senate. The Senate is not the problem. It's the state legislatures not demanding their suffrage. If the state legislatures were getting the suffrage that they're supposed to have out of that Senate, there have been treaties that never would have been signed. There are things that the government and bills that have passed through that Senate that never would have happened, and we wouldn't be so far down this terrible road of our destruction. It's that simple. It's just that the 17th Amendment gave everybody the excuse to blame it for the problem instead of actually our illiteracy, because the 17th Amendment didn't do anything. It wasn't the boogeyman. It's the fact that we just believe the lie that it did. And it gave everybody the excuse to say, oh, they can't do, I can't do anything. The state legislature sure can do something about it. Nobody wants to hold anybody accountable. This goes back to the very beginning of this show. This goes back to the bane of our existence. You know, the accountability is coming, whether it be in this life or the next. And I believe that everybody realizes that we're at that threshold where, you know, that we may be standing in front of that judgment seat pretty soon. So it's time to start getting
more
right.
More like that every day.
Yeah, it's time to start getting right with God. It's time to start getting right, you know, with, you know, holding our government accountable. And I say that by getting right with God, because it's not a fluke that we have the government we have. As a matter of fact, all the framers, again, next week, Thanksgiving, read the proclamation. Please set aside your Thanksgiving not to have a gluttonous feast of entertainment. Take Thursday and serve Him. Take Thursday as a day of sacrifice and service, and have your feast on Friday. If you can record it, then fine, record it. If you got to watch the games, but don't let the desirous carnal world continually give us the excuse of why, you know, this nation is what it is, and everybody says we need a revival. And if you're saying that we need a revival, but you're not taking the time on this coming Thursday to sanctify the Constitution, you're just as big a part of the problem as everybody. Until we start doing what's right. That's why learn, pray, act. Prove me wrong that the standard for giving thanks in America is a very specific process of thanking Him and serving Him and sacrificing your day and time to serve Him. Folks, let's start seeing how America really does get turned around, because we're actually doing something we should do instead of fulfilling our carnal desires and, you know, stuffing ourselves and getting drunk and watching games and so forth. We're equal participants in circus until we actually walk away and do what the framers had guided us to do. They set the example. Anyway, I digress. Are we good? If there's anything lingering that you wanted to say or a point.
Oh, no, sir.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if you were aware of that. I thought it struck me as completely ludicrous that's going on.
Yeah, no, so that's just how corruption works, and the Constitution...
But what about the House rules? Doesn't the House have the ability to remove people?
Yeah, they do, and actually that's in the Constitution for bad behavior, for those right. types of things. But when you look at the oath and what you're supposed to be doing, then, you know, that's not something that would be a hard, fast... I don't. What? Where is it in Article 1 that you can't, you know, allow somebody to whisper information? I mean, even when we watch the panels of investigations, somebody will whisper into the person conducting the investigation into their ear. Then, what about this? You know, because that happens. That happens all the time. The question is, you know, is was that person actually providing facts and details that were relevant in the impugning of the character of Cohen? I don't know. I'm not familiar with the case and all of that and what those questions were, what have you. But the point is that when it comes to your very specific oath, you're supposed to support the sovereignty of the states by protecting them from an invasion. You're supposed to ensure that our currency system is specifically gold and silver. You know, so those things that are in the Constitution, if we're deviating from them, every person under oath needs to be fighting tooth and nail to get back to those specific roles, responsibilities, and powers, and staying within them. Full compliance to the Constitution. I hope that makes sense. Now, there is a process for bad behavior, adultery, you know, being corrupt, taking bribes, because the Constitution it's not necessarily a violation of the Constitution, but it is a violation of your ethics. And so they do have the power and the ability to police and actually expel members. It's right there in Article 1. We covered it. You read this. So they have a method for dealing with that. But when it comes to their oath of office, by refusing to do anything to stop the invasion on the southern border, that right there, everybody that's not arguing and demanding that the militia be called and actually execute the repelling of the invaders. Not cherry picking, repelling the invaders. Now we've got very clear and concise language of what has to happen in the Constitution, and we got everybody. We got almost everybody with blood on their hands. I think even Rand Paul and even Marjorie Taylor Greene, even Massey. And the reason why, folks, is this is why I said we need to really look at this first and final and help everybody with the perspective to say, look, we know you are ignorant, but you better get smart and you better, before you vote on anything, you better demand how this can be proven as within your roles, responsibilities, powers, property. In other words, it's within the enumerations of the Constitution, because if it's not, then that bill needs to be rebuked and actually removed from the floor or whatever those actions are, blah, blah, blah. Hopefully that all makes sense. So anyway.
Yes, sir.
All right. Great, 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 great. So we got 12 and a half minutes, but we've got some documents to get into. So let's go ahead and let's, you know, continue with in making these remarks right here.
In making these remarks on the merits of the bill, he had reserved to himself, he said, the right to deny the authority of Congress to pass it. He had entertained this opinion from the date of the Constitution. His impression might perhaps be the stronger because he well recollected that a power to grant charters of incorporation had been proposed in the General Convention and rejected.
All right, so right there, and I believe we did read this, because the idea that in the convention, it was actually said, hey, we want, maybe we'll let the federal government create charters. And they said, no way. That's why it's not there. That's why the power to create the bank was not there. Now, this right here is huge. This wasn't in the language of what you read. That's why we want to go through this. Because they're going to pull out a few more little facts that actually speak to, you know, what is in the Constitution, what isn't in the Constitution, and why wasn't it there? And somehow, again, this goes back to what you also read, how Thomas Jefferson laid out how he convinced Madison in the Assumption Act to basically roll over and allow the assumption. Now, in the Assumption Act, you saw what it did, right? It actually laid out money to be, it laid out the foundation for the charter of the bank. They had no idea that the bank was coming. It was entwined with this, entwined, right? They were adjoined. They didn't know. And that was one of the things that just infuriated them, was he literally did a bait and switch on them. Because remember when we read that, we talked about how many millions of dollars was going out to this state and hundreds of thousands to this one. Remember, you remember that, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that was the Assumption Act. And now they're debating the creation of the Bank Act. But the Assumption Act laid the foundation for the bank because the money was going to be distributed to these agents that were going to be paid a certain salary even. It did everything but actually create the charter of the bank and, you know, how to create the bonds, all of those types of things. And so this little highlighted part, folks, I'm going to read it again. He well recollected that a power to grant charters of incorporation had been proposed in the General Convention and rejected. In other words, the language was there. They thought about putting it in, but they said, we're not putting it in because we don't want the federal government to be able to create charters and incorporations. So you've been a participant in a lot of debates on calls and so forth that we've had, where there's been lots of people making claims that the federal government has created these different charters, like the Charter of the Organic Act of D.C., and created the Federal Reserve and all these things, right?
Correct.
Clearly, they don't have the authority. There was a question, well, could they do it? Now you've actually read it for yourself. You've heard GR say it, but now you've actually read it. The concept of creating charters and incorporating entities as a federal government was being presented, the body of the whole rejected it and did not include that power or ability. Therefore, any of these things that the federal government has created, whether they be NGOs, whether they, it doesn't matter. Anything that's charter-based, incorporated, what have you, they have no authority to do it. It's unconstitutional. It's tyranny. Okay, so let's go down to the next small paragraph, sentence, and then the next one. Keep going with those two.
Is the power of establishing an incorporated bank among the powers vested by the Constitution and the legislature of the United States? This is the question to be examined. After some general remarks on the limitations of all political power, he took notice of the peculiar manner in which the federal government is limited. It is not a general grant out of which particular powers are accepted. It is a grant of particular powers only, leaving the general mass in other hands. So it had been understood by its friends and its foes, and so it was to be interpreted. As preliminaries to a right interpretation, he laid down the following rules. An interpretation that destroys the very characteristic of the government cannot be just. Where a meaning is clear, the consequences, whatever they may be, are to be admitted. Where doubtful, it is fairly triable by its consequences. In controverted cases, the meaning of the parties to the instrument, if to be collected by reasonable evidence, is a proper guide. Contemporary and concurrent expositions are a reasonable evidence of the meaning of the parties.
Okay.
In admitting... Okay,
so,
go ahead.
So there you go. Admitting evidence to the parties. That line right there. So we had a couple of highlighted lines. Right here, he's basically laying out that this was really clarified to the parties. What is he speaking of? He's actually speaking of the ratification debates, telling the states exactly, you know, these few powers that they have. If they don't have the power, if it is not delegated to them, they can't meddle with it. So here's the question, because I mentioned this when we started covering this. This is a great document. When going through these debates and hearing everything that Madison said, ask yourself, folks, why did these members of Congress ignore their scruples and actually vote contrary to how the Constitution was literally defined? Nobody could argue that Madison was wrong. You've heard me say several times the character of this man. He never once got corrupted. Any proof or any evidence out there that speaks otherwise, please bring it forward. I mean, he's a man, and I believe that he probably had some points where he did things that he regretted, but he never recanted these positions he took as to how the Constitution was to be defined. Going through all of the documents, which we're going to go through, the evidence is overwhelming that Madison was that pillar. He was, you know, that shining example of what and how we were to, you know, to use to understand the Constitution, clearly being the ratification debates. So you got to scratch your head and go, how in the heck did Hamilton persuade everybody to go with the Federalist Papers and his poisonous pills that he put into the end of it? Because there's money. If we corrupt government, people get money. If government is goody-two-shoes doing what it's supposed to do, nobody gets anything, right? So I just can't emphasize enough when we really kind of look at, you know, what our government is supposed to do and people wanting and why those men back then, there was something in it for them. The states were going to be happy. They were going to maintain their privilege and access to the trough. They may not have received, you know, direct stipends, but they knew that they were buying political leverage by sending money to their states, by doing things they didn't have the authority to do. And the wisdom of the men in the convention and the fact that they held the line, you know, it was just amazing that level of character and integrity was within that body of men, but obviously went completely absent in Congress. Huh? Yes? No? I think I lost Sean again, folks. Anyway, let's just let's just continue on. Let's go ahead and pick it up with in admitting or rejecting the constructive authority, because again, he's going to continually point to this how the Constitution was sold, and he's literally going through it. So go ahead.
In admitting or rejecting a constructive authority, not only the degree of its incidentality to an express authority is to be regarded, but the degree of its importance also, since on this will depend the probability or improbability of its being left to construction.
Okay, keep going.
Reviewing the Constitution with an eye to these positions, it was not possible to discover in it the power to incorporate a bank. The only clauses under which such a power could be pretended are either the power to lay and collect taxes to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare, or the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, or the power to pass all laws necessary and proper to carry into execution those powers. The bill did not come within the first power. It laid no tax to pay the debt or provide for the general welfare. It laid no tax whatever. It was altogether foreign to the subject.
Okay.
No argument could.
I'm sorry. At this point in time, you're actually, you know, we're kind of recovering those things that Madison stated in that other document. But in all fairness, again, this is another reference that we're already got out of that document, that the way the Constitution was, you know, in the contemporary discussions or in the ratification debates, they couldn't do these things. So why is it that we're actually even entertaining the ability to doing these things? And the crux of this, folks, is that Congress literally chose, so we can just wrap up on this and we kind of put this to rest. Folks, I would highly encourage you reading this entire, this is a larger summation, but in reading this and reading the other documents we provide you, it is clear, isn't it? What do you think, Sean?
It's absolutely clear.
So why is it that the Congress chose to actually go the wrong way? There had to have been something in it for them. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I think it makes sense. And it goes back to the same thing, the nature of man. They saw opportunity and the power in their positions, and they decided that they were going to, you know, do something to bolster that power. And the bank actually laid the foundation for that.
Amen. And what it ended up doing was it destroyed a lot of lives, and John Adams being one of them. And, you know, I guess you could look at it as comeuppance, right? Because John Adams at this point in time was the vice president, right? And so he was the president of the Senate. And whether he was the voting tie, he was there. And we don't have the debates in the Senate. So I'll just conclude on this. We don't have the debates in the Senate. But I would love to see, you know, any record where John Adams basically started lecturing them. You know, this is very dangerous. We should not be doing this. Because it seemed to fly through both the House and the Senate. When Madison made the mistake of saying, I will go ahead and not lead the charge against this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we're leading the charge on the Constitution.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. And with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.